see Mr. Steele last night?
Yes, as I came home, I saw him going to his apartment with a girl.
That girl was murdered between 1 and 2 o'clock this morning.
I hadn't anyone till you. I was a lonely one. Till you.
What's he doing here?
With or without his wife or tailing me?
I've been looking for someone for a long time. I didn't know her name or where she lived. I'd never seen her before. And a girl was killed, and because of that, I found what I was looking for.
First, you have to have enough imagination to visualize the crime.
You're driving up the canyon. Put your right arm around her neck. You get to a lonely place in the road, and you begin to squeeze. You're an ex-GI. You know judo. You know how to kill a person. Go ahead, bruv. Squeeze harder.
You know Dix didn't do it. You saw him after the girl left.
But Lochner has a different idea. He believes Dix could have done it. I left his office feeling as though he were trying to warn me. I came here because I wanted to say these things out loud and be laughed at. But you're not laughing.
Let me in.
So, are you taking to Las Vegas?
No, I know.
Are you packing to go on a honeymoon?
Yes, of course.
Are you packing to run away from me like you ran away from Mr. Baker?
Hello, welcome to Movie Humpers. My name is Bob Sham.
I'm Angela.
And the sounds here may be dogs, and it is our theme all month, all goddamn month long. We're in the last week, and I'm already going to miss it. I'm already going to miss it because this might be the most heavy hitters month ever. I'm just trying to imagine what all we've talked about. I don't think anything is under an 8. I really don't. Truly.
No, I don't. I can't think of one that.
I might be forgetting something, but like, I don't think anything is under an 8.
I was trying to think if I'd given anything less than a 4. I don't know if I have.
Nah, because I mean,
is perfect.
We truly have selected some like standout bangers. I think we'll be talking about 21 film noirs by the time it's all done. And like even narrowing that down and getting what I wanted.
I just want to point out that
I think some of the Marlowe movies may end up being lower.
As many as we have watched this month, we have also watched extra just for ourselves. That's how much we love this genre. Yeah. We're most likely to watch this type of movie outside of the parameters of this show,
yeah,
just for fun.
Well, we, you know, our Belcourt, our home theater, our independent, registered on the historical registry here in Nashville, we really take advantage of like certain times when they show old movies in the theaters because we want to revisit them. And if this movie ever shows up in the Bell Horse,
1,000%.
The Bell Horse.
The Bell Horse.
the Bell Court in Nashville, we're on that shit.
I'll take off work to see this in the theater.
This movie is great.
This might be one of my favorite movies.
But before we dive into this great, great movie,
yeah,
it is the last week, so I should explain that our theme for next month in April, we're revisiting. It's been about a year.
Yeah.
By around this time that we've been doing this show. And it took us a little bit to get our flow on. It was like, we were maybe talking about 1 or 2 a week, and then we got into a 3. And now I'm overbooking myself every other month. Because I'm just so excited to talk about movies. And I actually love scheduling movies and figuring out what we're going to discuss. That really gets my juices going. But
Bobby has woken me up in the middle of the night to tell me about a month that's happening like 9 months from now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very exciting.
Yeah, we are scheduled out literally like a year out.
I love it.
But next month, we're bringing back our awkward laughter theme. Mm-hmm. It's awkward laughter too. Now, last year's awkward laughter, we talked about those zany comedies, The Naked Gun, National Lampoon's, whatever. Because we were trying to get the feel of being consistent with a theme, we didn't really get to hit as many. So maybe we'll have to revisit zany comedy somewhere down the road. But the awkward laughter we're talking about next month are movies from our lifetime that are comedies that flopped.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these comedies kind of went on to become cult successes.
Yeah, there's a couple we're going to talk about that we actually love.
And some that are just kind of like notoriously tanked or are just notoriously divisive. So we've, with Women in Crisis last month, All Noir this month with The Left Hand Endeavor. Next month is going to cure that constant heavy hitter cycle because we're probably going to get at least a couple of real bad movies next month is my prediction. But I am fascinated by it. But for our classic selections next month, we will be, for a few weeks, we'll be devoted to Monday drops of Jerry Lewis movies. I did not grow up watching Jerry Lewis.
I did.
So, but I will say, unlike all the other selections we'll be talking about that month, Jerry Lewis was like a huge star. Like, made fucking money. That's the main difference between Jerry and all the other movies that we will be discussing, is that they made bank.
Absolutely they did. Now, looking back on these movies, there's going to be some issues. I'm just saying, with some things that happen in these movies.
The Geisha Boy or whatever? Yeah, oh, sure. Gosh.
Sure, but
I can't remember if we're actually watching.
I grew up watching these. I loved Jerry Lewis.
The French also loved him.
It was like a thing, the Martin and Lewis movies as well. I mean, there's straight, like, you know, Jerry Lewis, but when like Dean Martin's playing his straight man, like we watched a ton of that stuff.
I pointedly skipped Martin and Lewis. That's just cool. Went for Jerry main star.
Absolutely. Which I appreciate, but all of that. And even my family was so in love with Jerry Lewis that we also had a yearly tradition of when the muscular dystrophy telethon was on, we would stay up all night putting together puzzles and watching Jerry Lewis.
Mm.
My house, it was Elvis, John Wayne, and Jerry Lewis.
I just liked it when Jerry would put his mouth around like a pint glass. Have you ever seen images? Like, it was a shtick he did. He would, like, put his lips around a pint glass and just hold his head with, a glass sticking out of his mouth.
Maybe I've seen it. I don't know.
I feel like...
That didn't stick out to me.
Guess you're not a fan.
I am a fan. I feel like I've also seen people do that at the bar.
Well, yeah. They probably were inspired by Jerry Lewis. Enough of that. Left Hand Endeavor, last week. And we are tackling another Nicholas Ray movie. Nicholas Ray also directed They Live by Night, which we discussed in our first full week one, which is a pleasant surprise. He also, his most famous movie, probably Rebel Without a Cause. And this movie ended up being very personal for him because he was married to the lead lady, Gloria Graham, who you might remember as Violet from It's a Wonderful Life. He was married to her and they were separated when this movie was being made, but they didn't tell anyone. Yeah. And this movie, it stars Humphrey Bogart, Gloria Graham, Frank Lovejoy, Martha Ruth Stewart. Very loosely based on a book by, Dorothy Hughes.
Which is so interesting because part of the plot of this is him writing a book very loosely based on a screenplay very loosely based on a book.
I mean, I think I did watch a Nicholas Ray like hour long documentary. It's part of the supplementary of the Criterion version of this movie, which I do recommend specifically the criterion for this specific movie because the supplementary stuff is good. Mm-hmm. From that, I learned that this was an incredibly personal movie. Bogey, he plays a guy named Dix. Dix Steele. D-I-X Steele. And he is a Hollywood screenwriter who's had some rough luck with it since the war ended. And they're trying to get him to write this particular movie, but he ain't having it. He thinks it sucks.
He doesn't even want to read the book.
So this is an aspect of Nicholas Ray that I've come to learn, in that he was a guy that managed to have mainstream success in Hollywood despite the fact that he fucking hated dealing with the system itself. And that's exactly the Dick Steele character here. He's being offered these scripts. He's given this book and, like, everything sucks. Like, he makes it clear he wants to make real art. He wants to write real art. And there's even this aspects of, like, this young Hollywood trying to churn out a buck. And he's, like, criticizing people for, you know, I mean, Hollywood, any producer will be like, it's a business, it's a business. But Dix is presenting himself as someone who at least wants to put out something that is meaningful.
I won't work on something I don't like.
Dix, my boy, how many times must I tell you?
I know, it's just another picture.
But are you in any position to be choosy? You haven't written a hit since before the war, and your last picture...
So it stunk. Everybody makes flops except you. You haven't had one because you've made and remade the same picture for the last 20 years. You know what you are? You're a popcorn salesman.
That's right, so are you. The only difference between us is that I don't fight it.
Yes, but that's led him to have not written anything for, what they say, like 8 years or something?
Yeah, like not before, since before the war did he have a successful picture. So he's dealing with like these young scumbags coming up in Hollywood, these kiss-ass sycophants. They're disrespecting his old actor buddy friend.
Yes, which I understood him in that moment so well.
Yeah.
You know, there's this older guy who's not getting the jobs anymore, and so he drinks all the time, and guys like Dix kind of take care of him. Mm. They have this friend group who've all known each other for so long. Dix, his agent, this old actor guy, there's a couple other, like, tangential people. Yeah. But they all recognize that the dude is a drunk, but they also so appreciate who he is and what he's done. And he also, though the fact that he's drunk, he genuinely loves them. And he's a sweet guy to be around. You find out later that Dix actually gives him money, even. And even though Dix hasn't worked in a really long time.
So around this club, he kind of becomes connected. Well, he meets this young lady named Mildred Atkinson. Mm-hmm.
She's a coat check girl.
Who is played by Ruth Stewart, or just Martha Stewart. And he talks Mildred into coming over to his place late one night because he tentatively agrees to at least read this book. But he doesn't want to read the fucking book. He's like, I'll pay Mildred to read the book and then tell me the story.
She read it on her own.
Yeah.
It had gotten left there for him and she just picked it up and she was so into it. He's like, well, obviously you love it. You can just tell it to me.
Now, this seems like he's trying to... maybe trying to get a hookup at the same time.
Mm-hmm. It might have been an idea.
I think it was, but it's not one he's going to work too hard for.
And she ends up being annoying.
Yeah, a little bit. But he doesn't hate her or nothing. No. If this happens to work out this way, then it'll be fine, but I'm not going to try that hard.
Well, later he's asked, did you intend on anything happening? He goes, well, if I did, I didn't act on it. You know, it's that whole idea.
He pretty much explains it. Like, if she's going to make it easy for me, no problem.
Yeah, but as soon as she was like, oh, you're taking your shoes off. He was like, okay, just tell me the story. Yeah. Just tell me the story.
So we go through the scene where she explains it. She's like a nice lady, but she's a little goofy. But at the end of the night, he's fucking tired. And he's like, look, I can give you money for a cab. There's a station over here. Would it be all right? I know it's late. Would it be all right if I just didn't walk you out and I just hand you the money and go? And she's like, well, I guess that's okay. And so that happens. He goes to bed. The police show up, one of which is his old war buddy, who he was like under command, who was a major that he used to boss around. So they knew each other, but he's a cop. And so they bring him in for questioning. And it's kind of not very subtle. Like, I remember when they revealed, like, I kind of figured, like, oh, did something happen to Mildred? And I felt like I was more shocked that she was killed than Dix was.
Yeah, well, and what we don't see is so important. We don't see them tell him that she's dead.
Yeah, which is an interesting choice there.
Part of a conversation after,
yeah,
where he's just like chatting. And I love the way it's set up because it's assumed that he doesn't know yet because he's being so cool and just like kind of even like joking a little bit. You know, he's giving these like kind of like sarcastic answers, which is just his thing. And then you find out that he knows already and he's still acting this way, which is what the head investigator thought was so weird, is that he said, you know, so you're told this girl who was at your house,
yeah,
left your house and was found dead, and you're just sitting here giving like nonchalant answers. And he's like, what do you want me to feel?
I had the same feeling.
I did too. You're supposed to.
And this is an initial clue as to his kind of personality, yep, here. As this movie is set up, he's like Humphrey Bogart, as you would classically. He's a Hollywood writer. This is almost in the Sunset Boulevard realm,
yes,
of film noir. And that there's some like criticisms of character within the film industry. But yeah, we're sitting there, it's like, man, he's very flippant.
You're told that the girl you were with last night was found in Benedict Canyon, murdered, dumped from a moving car. What's your reaction? Shock? Horror? Sympathy? No. Just petulance at being questioned. A couple of feeble jokes. You puzzle me, Mr. Steele.
Well, I grant you the jokes could have been better, but I don't see why the rest should worry you. That is, unless you plan to arrest me for lack of emotion.
I know he didn't know her personal, but he was nice enough to her. You figured he'd be like, oh my God, that's so awful, at the very least. You naturally feel the bogey one-liners. He's a Hollywood writer, so he's quippy, he's smart. You, yeah, get that. And then you sit through this scene, and it's like, that really is kind of completely inappropriate.
Did you think he was guilty?
No.
I never did.
No. And I think it's not supposed to make you think he's guilty.
Yeah, yeah. But it makes the way he acts.
Because we know he's not.
We know he's not. The way he acts makes the other people think that he is.
Yeah.
And it's almost.
And you get it, though.
You get it, but it makes it more frustrating because you're like, Bogey, just shut the fuck up.
Dicks.
But it's interesting because, you know, he leaves after he's been questioned and he does say, oh, there was a woman who saw me, because he needs an alibi. He doesn't have one. And the woman who saw him is our gorgeous
Laurel
leading lady.
Gloria Graham.
I love her. Perfect in this role, but
she does provide an alibi for him. And they also officially meet through this.
Yes, because so he saw her when they were first coming in, and obviously she probably was like, oh, who's just bringing a girl home? You know, she had just moved into the apartment across from his. So they're kind of across a courtyard from each other. The thing that's interesting is she gives him an alibi, but she lies. Because she saw him when they were coming in, and then later there's this part where the girl's still telling him the story because she's just yelled. And then she says, help, help. And he's like, quiet down. I have neighbors. And he looks out at that point and he sees the lady across the way in a negligee. And they kind of have a moment where they stare at each other. But then he closes it. Then he sends the girl home shortly after. She says that she saw him alone in his apartment after the girl was gone. And that was a lie.
Through his blinds or whatever. Yeah.
And it's interesting because then, you know, he asks his agent, like, who's this woman? You know, she finds out she's an actress. She was dating this, like, rich real estate man that she ran away from. But also within that, like, she lies to protect him. And she says she doesn't know him. And they were like, well, why'd you pay so much attention? And she says, well, I like his face. After she leaves, the head investigator is asking his guy who was in the army with him, why do you think he was acting that way? And he said, he has always been that way. We could never read him. None of us ever knew what he was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
He was great. He's like loyal. You know, he did his job.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have emotions, basically.
And it's really interesting because, you know, we know as an audience that he didn't commit this
Absolutely.
Crime.
He fell asleep. He's been asleep.
So we think we're going into kind of like this angle of a mystery where he's going to have to figure out how to clear his name, because obviously he's going to probably help solve a murder, maybe.
But he's not trying to clear his name. He's walking around talking like, well, if I did do it. I mean, he's very...
Yeah.
This is how I think it would be done.
And he... But it seems like also his only real friend, other than some of the people we meet at the club, is this cop guy. And so, like, yeah, and we meet...
His agent and the cop and the old drunk actor.
Yeah, and the cop has this wife who has very... the cop's wife, her expressions of being disconcerting are very good.
She's
like, what the... She's got... Great. She almost has this... constant, like, what the fuck is going on? Look about her face.
I loved her so much. She's also one of those people who I can empathize with, because occasionally she sticks her foot in her mouth.
Yeah.
And causes a big problem that she never meant to cause. I liked her a lot.
Dix and Laurel are, they're getting to know each other, and Laurel's playing it, you know, ladylike, trying to push back, but this is a movie from this time. So they fall madly in love in 3 days. And then they kind of have, it feels like things have passed like months, but
it's been a few weeks.
It's only been like maybe a week.
There is this scene. Well, at one point when they call her back in for more questioning, they say it's been 3 weeks. Mm. And so, you know, she lives across the courtyard, but you can tell they're always together at one house or the other. And there's this lovely scene where the agent comes over, who's kind of like a father figure to Dix in a way. He kind of treats him that way and loves him in that way. And he comes in to see them, and she answers the door, and she's talking about, oh, he's writing. Like, he's like completely out of it. And I love it when he's like this.
Dixon.
Huh?
Nell is here to take you to the beauty contest.
I'll be ready in a minute.
He thinks you'll be voted Mr. America.
Good.
Are you really the handsomest man alive?
Yep. Just let me finish this page.
And the agent actually says he hasn't been this way in so long.
Yeah.
You know, he hasn't been this way. This is because of you. But he's not sleeping. He's just writing. But they're so obviously in love. It's so sweet.
There's an aspect to the investigation where not only that Dix is the last known person to see Mildred alive, but that he's also a guy that has written stories in which people get killed.
Oh, yeah. At one point he says, I've killed dozens of people in my books.
So he's over, he's having like a dinner with his cop buddy and his wife.
At their house.
And I love this fucking scene so much, but it's also very funny.
And fucked up.
He's trying to explain what he thinks kind of happened as to whoever killed Mildred.
She had a boyfriend,
yeah,
who she canceled a date with to go tell him this story. And he, from the beginning, has said, have you talked to Kessler?
And that's also what we're saying at the screen throughout the movie. Like, what about the boyfriend?
Isn't it, what is it, like 90% of the time? It's the boyfriend or the wife or the whoever?
So he has them sit down, the cop and his cop buddy and the wife, walking him through what he thinks happens. He's like, imagine, you know, you're just driving along, like the way she was strangled, getting shoved out of a moving car. Like, they pick up, they have all these facts. And he's like, well, you put these facts together, right? And imagine you're just with this girl and she's driving you crazy and you got...
She's telling you she's done nothing wrong. You pretend to believe her. You put your right arm around her neck. You get to a lonely place in the road and you begin to squeeze. You're an ex-GI. You know judo. You know how to kill a person without using your hands. You're driving the car and you're strangling her.
Getting hyper... super into being like, and then it gets tighter.
He's directing them.
You don't see her bulging eyes or protruding tongue. Go ahead, bruv. Squeeze harder. You love her, and she's deceived you. You hate her patronizing attitude. She looks down on you. She's impressed with celebrity. She wants to get rid of you. You squeeze harder. Harder. Squeeze harder. Wonderful to feel her throat crush under your arm.
Rob, stop it!
Humphrey Bogart, in this particular scene, completely breaks the veneer of his own caricature.
Mm-hmm.
Like, his classic Hollywood image. And he's actually, like, fucking acting, right? I mean, he's an actor. He's a good actor.
Yes.
But he's like a classic leading character acting man. He's not expected to go on these intense ranges. But this one, he completely shatters that manufactured image. And he genuinely looks like a fucking fetishist creep.
This photo.
The image right above my head. That's the image I'm talking about. His guard is down. He looks like he's getting off on like trying to explain and like assert this idea of this murder. But his cop buddy, what's funny is like the wife, the cop's like actually squeezing.
He's
and the wife,
into it.
And the wife's like,
ah! Rob, stop it.
I didn't hurt you, did I?
No.
The cop seems so gullible, like he's been hypnotized into accidentally strangling his wife.
Absolutely.
Or something.
Absolutely. And then she, like, you know, says, like, stop, stop. And he lets go of her. And she says to Dix, she says, well, you forgot one thing. What about my hands? And he said, well, she would have done the same thing that you did. And grabbed
the arm.
You're not going to think to start punching it. She's like, I could scratch his eyes out, but you didn't.
And you also get that Dix probably did actually describe what actually happened.
Absolutely, he did.
But that scene is so fucking good. And also genuinely funny. Like, the cop kind of comes off like a gullible idiot. Like, like he's just going to do, I am going to squeeze tighter. We get Dix being very glib about just finding out this lady that was in his house is killed. We see him get, like, weirdly horny, doing method acting on some murder assumption. We also get information from the police that in a previous relationship, he was actually abusive. And we meet the ex, and she seems to not hold a grudge on him.
At the beginning of the movie, we find out later that it's her, but at the beginning of the movie, she's trying to get with him.
Yeah.
She's like, I was calling you all night. And he said, well, I don't answer my phone.
But they had domestic problems. Apparently, he was violent with her. So we
broke her nose, but then later she denied.
So even though we know he didn't kill this woman, we're starting to unravel the fact that this guy actually has extreme anger issues. There's a scene where he and Laurel, Gloria Graham, they're driving a car, and this guy like cuts him off or something or almost hits him. It actually doesn't seem like a big thing.
It's because Bogey's already mad, or Dix is already mad, because they were at the cop and his wife's house, and this is when the wife sticks her foot in her mouth, where she says something that Laurel told the cops when she got called in again that 3 weeks later. She didn't tell Dix that she got called in.
Right.
So then he's like,
she didn't want to worry him.
They still think it's me. You're lying to me. And he gets pissed and runs off, and she basically has to jump in the car to go with him. And he is driving like a fucking maniac. So it's actually his fault.
Yeah,
but he gets mad. Totally. He scrapes the other guy's car, and the guy's like, you see my car? My paint job cost $200. And then he loses it.
He runs him down and beats his ass on the side of the road.
Picks up a rock.
And what's funny is that person, because this is Los Angeles, Hollywood or whatever, that person, they see that person's name in the paper, like that person ended up being like another actor or something. Not a character essential to the story, but it just so happened to like show like this actor got his ass beat by this writer. And when Gloria Graham is trying to like call him on it, he doesn't reference the fact that he was a dick driving insane cause a thing. He was like, yeah, he called me a so-and-so or something. Like, it was just about that last thing and not the thing that led to all of that.
He was beating him and he had picked up a rock, and she actually yelled, stop, you're going to kill him.
Yeah. Yeah, he was going to, right. He was going to, like, literally brain him with a rock.
And this was the moment that put doubt in her mind, because she starts seeing him being so violent. You know, even before that, she couldn't get through to him.
She sees he has a capacity for violence, that he's drawn to it. And there's a, you know, this is a rare performance for a Humphrey Bogart. There's a, I'm trying to remember the name of the movie, but there was another movie he was in where he was actually the villain of it, in which he was like a commanding officer who tried to court-martial these guys, even though they did something. What is the name of that fucking movie? But it's one where he was like kind of an asshole in that one. And there, other than this, I mean, this is this movie almost tricks you like you're going to see your typical Humphrey Bogart movie. And then it's like, oh, this guy is completely unsettling, right? You know he's not a killer, but you can't blame everyone. You can't blame the people around him for, like, having these doubts.
Yeah, he's not a bad guy, but he has anger issues. And he's honest about that at some point. He says to her, like, I get mad sometimes, and I regret it afterwards. It's almost like they're in this spiral where he's almost, like, manic sometimes because he's so in love with her. But then the littlest thing happens and he gets crazy mad.
Yeah.
You know? And so she's being worried about all this. She goes and talks to the cop's wife and starts telling her all this stuff. She's like, I don't really have anybody I can talk to. And I really wanted to come and, like, lay out what I'm thinking and have you laugh at me. But you're not laughing.
Yeah.
Because this woman has seen it enough.
She literally saw him bust in his jeans.
When her husband was choking her out in their living room?
Yeah. She saw him paint his trousers
right in front of her. There's this moment where he comes over to her house and she's been having terrible dreams and she is kind of avoiding him because she's trying to figure out what she wants to do and she's already thinking about leaving him. She runs away. She's a girl who runs away. She doesn't face it. She just disappears.
Yeah.
And we never meet her ex-boyfriend, but he's referenced so much through the movie as, like, the man she went away from.
It's a real misdirect. Like, you almost think this is all going to converge into some, like, murder solution.
I thought so, too.
The, like, whole movie.
He went to get her and found that other girl instead.
I'm sitting by you this whole movie up until, like, the last 15 minutes where I'm like, she did it. Like, I'm sitting there saying she did it. No, that's not the case.
Anyone could have done it. But it's this beautiful scene where he has woken her up and she's finished typing his screenplay. And he's in the kitchen and he's going to make grapefruit. And he pulls out this knife and it's bent.
Yeah.
And he straightens it. But then she comes in and laughs at him.
What happened to the grapefruit knife?
Oh, it was crooked and I straightened it.
Fool. It's supposed to be curved.
What? Hmm. Wonder what they'll think of next.
It's a grapefruit knife.
It's a grapefruit knife.
I will say I've never heard of a grapefruit knife.
I haven't either, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
And just that whole thing of it's bent and he tries to straighten it, but it wasn't supposed to be straight. It's just this. Like, he's not how you think he's supposed to be, but he can't be something else.
Yeah.
This is just how he is, you know? And so he says to her, she's sitting across the kitchen from him, and he's doing the grapefruit with the knife he's just broken. And she's talking about how she loved the love scene in the screenplay, and he says,
well, that's because they're not always telling each other how much in love they are. A good love scene should be about something else besides love. For instance, this one. Me fixing grapefruit, you sitting over there dopey, half asleep. Anyone looking at us could tell we were in love.
The funny part about that is they don't look in love in that moment because she
is scared.
Thinking about leaving him. She's scared. We see that, but he doesn't know.
She does love him, but she's also a little smarter than a lot of women in this position in that she's not sure. And you don't blame her because he's so volatile. She's not sure if he's not the killer.
And he says, let's get married.
And there's a lot of things that kind of go into it where she's kind of trying to pack behind his back because she does decide to leave, but they're supposed to go on a trip. And she's getting plane tickets behind his back. But it all, you know, we won't go into the weeds of that, but it culminates into this point where he figures out that she's going to leave. And he gets a phone call about a ticket being canceled to New York. And that's how he finds out that she's going on a flight. And also she's just acting very flighty and weird. And it's just making him angrier to see her behave like that.
He was already angry earlier that night and hit his agent. Like he's already right, on like a 9. Friend,
he like punched him, which is just adds to her overall like, oh, this is a big problem. So she's getting ready to leave. Meanwhile, the thing that we've been saying, like, what about the boyfriend? What about the boyfriend the whole time? This is so great how it kind of does this. that this whole murder that you're like, who did this? Who did this? At one point, the police are like, yeah, the boyfriend confessed. It was just like insane. He apparently
tried to shoot himself in the stomach.
Yeah.
And had written it all down. So they had a written confession and he was in the hospital. And before Dix left the restaurant to go after her, the phone rang for him.
Yeah.
And you know it was the cop trying to tell him, oh, we got this confession.
We know it's not you guys.
But he was already gone.
Yeah.
And so he goes to her already mad, thinking she's mad because he hit his agent, who's their friend, not because...
And then he finds out she was planning on leaving, packing, and then he gets over her. And he starts choking her.
I love you, Dix. I'll marry you. I'll go away with you. Take me.
Run away from me the first chance you get.
Don't act like this, Dix. I can't live with a maniac.
I'll never let you go.
Dix, don't. Don't. Dix, please. Don't, Dix. Please, don't.
And while he's doing this, the phone rings. We know who it is. It's the cops being like, we got the killer. We got the confession. Fortunately, he stops. And then he kind of like instantly is like, oh my God, what am I doing? And then he walks over to the phone and then he answers the phone and they're like, look, we're sorry we put you and Laurel through all this. We'd like to apologize to her, but it was the boyfriend and we got the confession.
You're in the clear.
And then he very dejectedly, this should be something that he's like, yes, finally. But no, he's lost in this dark version of himself and seeing it for what it is. And he's like, they want to talk to you. It's the police. And
he puts the phone down and he walks across the room. Like, he knows he can't even be near her. Like, he goes and stands by the door and she comes out of the room and picks up the phone.
And then they're like, we really apologize for all that we put you guys through. And then she says,
yesterday, this would have meant so much to us. Now it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all.
And he walks out. It's done. They're not going to be together. He freaking tried. He choked her. Like, he maybe would have killed her. She knows that he knows that he's too volatile to make this work. She knows this is never going to work.
They just can't go back from that.
And we see him just dejectedly just walk through the courtyard, just profoundly disappointed in himself, which is really, I mean, we established that he has some kind of like, in the beginning, that he has a heart. He has kind of a moral sense of what he wants. He wants things to be, have meaning. Someone who wants good art, sees beauty in the world, but also that kind of person can be extremely, like, you know, volatile. They doesn't mean they can't be dangerous.
Yeah.
And so it's just a man who's reflecting on an intense problem that he has. Now, remember, I said that Nicholas Ray and Gloria Graham are married, separated secretly throughout this whole production. Their relationship is dead. And he's directing this movie about this couple that are in love. And by the end of it, it's just a relationship that cannot go forward. Apparently, the original idea was that he literally was supposed to kill her. Like, that was actually it. And then Ray was like, I want to do this different. And apparently that last bit was improvised completely.
It's perfect. And I think.
And the thought of, like, having him kill her, it does have the dramatic weight. I think it still would have been a great movie. But there's something, I guess just knowing that little extra layer of it, it does help to perceive it as a little more special. And Humphrey Bogart cites this movie as his favorite, looking back on his career. And this is a guy who made like 100 fucking movies. And many, plenty of good ass movies. Yeah. And combine 1 through 5, it's a five.
It's a five.
Yeah, this is one of the great, great bogey movies. Classic Hollywood themed film noir. Like we said, definitely in league with that Sunset Boulevard.
Absolutely.
Critique of an industry. It's just a bogey performance that goes beyond mm-hmm. what his expectations in the industry were.
Yep.
And Nicholas Ray, one of the best in that time here, just from the few that we know of.
Yeah.
Very impressive movie. Highly recommended. It's an S tier, baby. Once it hits over a 9, it's just S tier. It's just one long list. So we got it. And it happens to be right above another movie starring Gloria Graham. It's a Wonderful Life. It's in between Heat and It's a Wonderful Life. Hell right yeah. Where it belongs. Nicholas Ray's In a Lonely Place. Highly recommended. It's just been heavy ass hitters all month long. And this week as we roll out is no exception. Mm-hmm. All right. So when we'll be, I think it's tomorrow. I mean, these are all classics, but tomorrow is going to be another well-regarded film history classic movie starring a Mr. Orson Welles. Although he's only in it for like 5 fucking minutes.
But you know, that's like the most perfect Orson Welles part. He was like, give me that one. Like, I'm just going to be the man in the shadows and speak like 5 lines and be infamous.
I think if y'all are up on your film noir, I think it's a pretty easy
to guess.
$100 Jeopardy question to guess what we're talking about here. But that said, check the links for show notes and other places to find us. Remember, we got some comedies all for month long, some cult flops, but we will be wrapping up the Left Hand Endeavor this week. Like, subscribe, comment, corrections, fun facts. Let us know what you think of In a Lonely Place. If you're like, this movie sucks, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. You're insane. I don't even want to hear it. Can you imagine people being like, I don't like black. I don't like old movies. I don't like black and white movies. They're never going to watch this movie. It's like you're just making a sucker out of yourself. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I meant to type up. I wanted you because you've been going. Yeah, see for all the yeah. like the. I think Jimmy Cagney said that shit. I can't remember.
I don't know.
But I've been meaning to type up the monologue that Sherry says when she gets shot in the killing.
Yes.
Because it's so funny. But we'll, we keep forgetting. We're recording a lot of these ahead of time. So maybe I'll type that up and it'll be completely out of order from when this episode drops.
Yeah. I mean,
are you going to look up what Sherry says?
We still have a little bit. I was going to see if I could find it quickly. Do you want me to just do it?
Yeah, do it.
It isn't fair. I never had anybody but you.
That was a lie.
Not a real husband. Not even a man. Just a bad joke without a punchline.